will take the photographs and still frames in your mind. Hanging on a shelf in good health and good time. Tattoos and memories and dead skin on trial. For what it's worth, it was worth all the while. It's something unpredictable, but in the end it's right. I hope you had the time of your life. It's something unpredictable, but in the end it's right. I hope you had the time of your life.
Good morning. Grab your Bibles and open them to Ruth chapter 3. We're at message 4 in a 5-part series on the book of Ruth. Book of Ruth is an incredible story of how God works in ordinary circumstances to work out his incredible plan. And today we come to the most difficult, strangest, weirdest, most unusual passage you're going to read in the book and maybe in the Bible. And we're going to dive in together and figure it out together as we go along. Now, as you're turning there, some of you have been with us through the whole series, some of you have not. So let me quickly do an overview to catch you up to date on where we've been in our study. Now, Ruth is kind of a short story. And so in it, it contains a theme that runs through it, but it's built on the characters and their individual lives. Now, what we find in the book of Ruth is that you see God's providence working all the way through the book, but there are no visions, there are no voices, and there are no visible miracles. And yet, out of the 85 verses in the book, 23 times the name of God is mentioned. And almost every one of those times, it comes from the lips of the characters themselves as they live out their experience. The book is set in the time of the judges. The time of the judges was about a 100-year period, about 1,000 years before the birth of Christ. And it was the time between when the nation of Israel had come into the land of Israel. They owned that land. Up until the time when the first king, King Saul, came on the scene, and during that time was a time of anarchy and sin. The nation of Israel was constantly getting involved with the pagan worship of the tribes around. They were in the midst of clan warfare. They were doing all kinds of terrible things, and it was a time of sin and judgment and some really incredible stories. You'll remember people like Samson and Gideon and some of those guys that occurred during that time, but it was a really bad time. And right in the middle of that, we get a snapshot of one individual family and what their story was in the book. The family was led by a father named Elimelech. Elimelech, my God is king, that's what his name meant. Elimelech was experiencing what everybody in Bethlehem was experiencing. The city of Bethlehem means the house of bread, was starving for food. There was a famine in the land, probably caused by a drought, a picture of God's judgment on the people because the people were not being obedient to God. And Elimelech, trying to figure out what he was going to do, made an economic decision. I will move my family to the land of Moab, where it appears that there's more food. And when Elimelech decided to do that, he did what most men do today. You make moves for economic reasons. Better job, more money, promotion, but don't think through the ramifications of the spiritual, emotional, and physical conditions for your family. So, men following the money, Elimelech decides to go to Moab. The problem is the land of Moab is a very pagan place. In fact, Moab was born out of incest. If you go back to Genesis chapter 19, Lot's daughter slept with him, and the child was named Moab, and the people of Moab were very, very promiscuous. They worshipped a god named Chemosh. It was very much centered around child sacrifice. It was a very wicked place. He's not thinking about that. He's thinking about the money. How am I going to make a living? How am I going to support myself? So he doesn't check out the churches, doesn't check out the schools. Doesn't ask the question, you know, what kind of youth group are my kids going to be in? Who's going to help mentor them? Who's going to be a support for my wife? Will there be any Bible studies there? Will there be anything there to help me in my growth? He just follows the money and moves. Let the rest of it figure itself out. Elimelech gets there with his wife Naomi, her name means pleasant one, two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, and when they get there, Elimelech dies. So trying to escape death, he moves his family to a pagan place, and then he dies. And it appears that it's hopeless until the two boys marry. Now, they marry Moabite women, which was strictly forbidden, but they did it anyway. That's all that was available. So they married Orpah and Ruth, two Moabite women, and things seem to be going well, but then 10 years later, they die, leaving no children. And so Naomi and her two daughters-in-law are left without any help in a pagan land. What they do is they hear that God has shown favor on his people, that God has brought the rains to Bethlehem, that the crops are growing. And so Naomi decides to pack up and leave, and Orpah and Ruth initially decide to come with her. And as they're traveling, Naomi looks at her two daughters-in-laws and says, listen, I really have nothing to offer you, no economics, I have no husband for you, I have nothing to give you, and so go back to your people. And Orpah chooses to do that, but Ruth has a true conversion experience. Ruth said, no, I'm going to go with you, and I'm going to adopt your God. I will believe in your God, I will follow your God, I will be part of your people. So she travels to Bethlehem, to the people of God, where she can grow. It'll be like someone coming to faith in Jesus and moving to Austin to plug into Hill Country Bible Church so they could have a church home, get involved in a Bible study, have some support, have some encouragement. She's going to go with Naomi back to Bethlehem with her new faith. And when she gets back there, Naomi is greeted by all the people. Now, Naomi's name, Pleasant One, when she walks down the street and people say, ah, is this Naomi? Her response is, don't call me Naomi, Pleasant One, call me Mara, Bitter One. Because God has made my life bitter. I went away with a husband and two sons. I went away full. I'm coming back empty. She's just devastated and broken. Her life is just miserable. And she's impoverished. She has no protection. And she comes back with Ruth. Chapter 2 begins with Ruth saying, rather than us starve to death, I'm going to go out and do something. So she decides to go out and glean in the fields. Gleaning in the fields would be the poor person's way of trying to make a living. So it's kind of like going down to manpower or something like that, where you can kind of go to the labor pool for the day and get some work for the day. And so she goes out to do this. And as she's gleaning in the field, God leads her to the field of Boaz. Now, this is a find. Because Boaz is loaded, Boaz is a man of character, and Boaz is available. I mean, ladies, what more could you want? The guy's good standing, good reputation, he's got the big bucks, and he's available. And in addition to that, when Boaz meets Ruth, Boaz prays for her, he blesses her. I mean, it just seems like this is the perfect man. She goes home and she tells Naomi, and Naomi says, it's even better than that, Ruth. Not only is he the perfect man, but he's a kinsman, which means he could perform a levirate marriage, which would allow them to have a child to raise up to Elimelech and keep the clan alive, which would give them the opportunity to inherit the property, to get the family back together, to make things work. And so they are so excited because obviously God has brought the man of her dreams into her life. He invites her to work in his field, but then day two goes by and day three goes by and day four goes by, and you can imagine the conversation. I mean, think about it. Like Ruth comes home and Naomi says, well, did you see him today? Did he talk to you? Is he kind of giving you that look? Like he might be interested? No, no conversation. And day after day after day after day, nothing is happening. Nothing's taking place. And the harvest is about to run out. 6 weeks, 7 weeks, they're going on the 8th week, and she's got a temp job. Like after this gig runs out, she's not going to see him anymore. There'd be no reason for them to get together. And so what in the world is a girl to do? Now, here's where this passage becomes very interesting, because the biblical way for a girl in her position to respond to a potential offer of marriage would be to do it through her father. In fact, when you look at how the Bible talks about marriage, it talks about a man taking a wife and a girl or a daughter being given in marriage. We see that in the marriage ceremony even today, where the father walks the daughter down the aisle, stands with her, and the pastor says, "Who gives this woman to be married to this man?" And the answer is, "Her mother and I do." In other words, our family is giving her to you. And so the idea, even back to Genesis chapter 2, it says, "For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother." What does that mean? That means go out and get a job, make a life, find a church, begin to grow as a man, get a clue before you take on the responsibility of marriage. Get out there, get responsible. And it's the responsibility of the family, particularly the father, to ensure that the guy is not a jerk before he gives his daughter to her to be married. And that provides protection for the daughter and for the family. Now, I know in our culture today, that is so foreign. And some of you may even feel like that, you know, that's the old, that's the patriarchal system. But let me just ask you, is what we're doing working very well? Is it working very well? I don't know about you, but I have two daughters. And I care about my daughters. I love my daughters. And I kind of have this feeling that as much as they may think they know what's in their heart, I think I'd be a really good judge of helping them pick their future spouse. And that's why, since the time they were this big until the time that they are this big, and they are literally this big, I repeat on a regular basis, you don't worry about the guys, let Dad pick them. I can do a better job than you can do. Trust me, I know men. That's the biblical way. Now, dads, if you're going to have the opportunity to influence your daughter's choice of a future spouse, you better begin today to invest in her life in such a way that she knows you love her, that she knows you care about her, that she knows that you are the center, that she is the center of your emotional world. And outside of Jesus Christ and your wife, she is it, and you think she's wonderful. Because if she doesn't believe that, you know what she's going to believe? She's going to believe some silly junior high boy who tells her that she's the center of his world. And he doesn't know what the center of his world is yet. Dads, can you imagine? Think about it. Some of you are experiencing this right now. Your daughters care more about what a 16-year-old boy thinks of them than they do what you think of them. They are more interested in the love of a 16-year-old boy. Can 16-year-old boys love? Guys, can they? More interested in the love of a 16-year-old boy than they are of knowing what their daddy feels about them. And if you care about your girls, dads, you will get involved. I'm so proud of our guys. This weekend, we had a father-daughter camp out. And we had 120 men and 170 girls out on this father-daughter camp out. What an awesome thing to invest in the lives of their daughters. A few months ago, one of the girls in our church had a serious accident. And so somebody set up a prayer account for her to keep up with her progress on Facebook. And in order for me to figure out and keep up with what's going on, I had to get a Facebook account to keep up with that. And as soon as I discovered that I was on Facebook, had my account set up, then a whole bunch of you started pinging me, and now like I got all these friends. Which has been kind of cool, because now I really understand what high school and college people think, and it's been real insightful. But my daughter friended me, which is kind of nice. I've got a daughter that's studying abroad. She's a junior in college. Then I have a daughter who's a sophomore in high school, my daughter Ellen, and she friended me. So I get on her Facebook, and I look at her picture on her Facebook, and here's what was there when I got on there. That's the picture. Now, here's why I love this picture. Because when some 15, 16-year-old boy looks at this picture, for one thing, he can't tell that Ellen's 6'1", which scares most of them away anyway. But when he looks at this picture, what he sees is that if I want her, I've got to go through him. And that's a good thing. And if there's a boy out there, and in their mind and in their heart, they think it's not worth it, you know what I think? She's too good for him. She's too good for him. Because if there's a boy out there that doesn't have the character to want to know the dad of the girl that he's dating, doesn't have the character to want to understand this family and respect this family and to get to know them, to be part of them, if all he wants is her attention and her affection and nothing more, then he's not ready to date my daughter. He's not ready to be with my daughter. That's the way it was supposed to be. The problem is Ruth, we don't know whether she has a dad or not. He's in Moab if she has a dad. So there's nobody there to help her in this connection. Now, there's another way to go about this. If you don't have a family to help you with this, the second way to go about this is to do it the Moabite way. The Moabite way is very similar to the Austin way. And that is, you get out there, you present yourself, get involved in sexual relationships, kind of make sure everybody has a chance to taste the forbidden fruit, and you try to hope through that process that you can land somebody that you can get along with, and that kind of that hedonistic approach, that's what took place in Moab. It takes place in Austin. That's what we're mostly used to. People getting together, hanging out, shacking up, sleeping together, hopefully through that, a love connection might be made. And we all know there's a lot of emotional and spiritual wreckage that takes place along the way in that. The third option is the option that Naomi comes up with. And this is the most bizarre thing in the whole wide world. So as we jump into the passage, hang on. I'm not necessarily prescribing this to you, but this is what they did. What we see is they come up with a risky plan. And in the passage, we see that they're seizing the opportunity that's before them. They come up with a risky plan to seize the opportunity. Starting in chapter 3, verse 1, it says, "One day Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, 'My daughter, should I not try to find a home for you where you will be well provided for?'" Now in chapter 1, verses 8 and 9, she had prayed that God would give them a home. Now she's saying, maybe I should be the answer to that prayer and come up with a way to help you get connected, to have a husband, to have a home, to have security, so you don't spend your whole life out there trying to scrape up the leftovers to provide for yourself. And then she says in verse 2, "Is not Boaz, with whose servant girls you have been, a kinsman of ours? Tonight he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor." Watch this good advice. "Wash and perfume yourself. Put on your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he has finished eating and drinking." Now, this is some great advice, ladies. Some really, really good advice. Now, oftentimes, single girls will go talk to other single girls to try to figure out what guys want or need. Don't do that. Go talk to a married woman. She's got somebody. She knows. Okay? She says, listen, clean yourself up. You know, every time he's seen you before, it's been in a work context. You know, ponytail, all sweaty, sweatpants. You know, he's seen you in that look. Put on your best clothes. In other words, present yourself to him as being feminine, being marriageable. Don't present yourself as simply being a worker. So take a bath. Get some perfume. Little Estee Lauder. You know, go to the tanning booth, you know, get a tan, get your nails done. Little lipstick wouldn't hurt. Maybe do something with those locks. Do something. Make yourself presentable. Put on some nice clothes and then go to the threshing floor where they're all partying tonight. But when you get there, make sure you don't approach him before he's had something to eat and drink. Now, ladies, men have a priority order in which they're receptive. After he's had his wings, had a chance to fill up a little bit, then you can approach him. If you approach him before that, I mean, just think about it. Like, Boaz, we need to talk. We need to talk. There's the food over there. He's looking at the food. We need to talk. We need to define the relationship. Like, I don't know where I stand. You seem so ambivalent about this relationship, and I need to know. Hey, after he's had his food, cowboy game is over. He's much more receptive to a conversation. So she says, wait till he's had his food. Wait till he's in good spirits. Wait till he's ready. And then gives this additional strange advice. Says to her, when he lies down, note the place where he is lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do. Now, that's why I'm not recommending this. Generally speaking, ladies, do not look at a man after he's had his fill of food and drink and say, hey, I'm lying at your feet. You know, whatever you tell me to do, I'm going to do it. Don't do that. Now, we're going to find out that there's more to it than that as we get a little deeper in the story, but that's what Naomi's directing her to do. This is an opportunity. He's going to be at the threshing floor. This is a great time to get before him, to get in front of him, and let him know that you are available and desirous of marriage, if that's what he wants, and put it out there for him. In other words, take a risk. Now, we move from this to a risky proposal. Started with a risky plan, now we move to a risky proposal, and that risky proposal is a proposal where she comes forward and she says, in faith, makes a faith statement of what she's hoping to see happen in the relationship. So, notice what takes place. Verse 5, I will do whatever you say, Ruth answered. So she went to the threshing floor and did everything her mother-in-law told her to do. Now, it's a risky proposal because in many ways, she could have been in huge trouble. First thing he could have done was just reject her outright. You know, you're a gold digger, I'm rich, you're poor, and I'll laugh in your face. I just mock you for even trying. He could have also accused her of immorality. He could have said, what are you doing coming to me at night? Yeah, obviously this is a sexual proposal. You're an immoral woman and completely tarnished her reputation. He could have taken advantage of her and then just left her. So she's trusting that God's going to do something here. So look what happens. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Now keep in mind that this is the first time they've had a big harvest in a long time. They've been in a famine, so they're having this great time threshing out the grain, big pile. They're eating, they're drinking, they're having a great celebration of God's blessing. And what happens in there is, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain. Ruth approached quietly, you know, kind of like a ninja, sneaking along, uncovered his feet and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man. That was the purpose of uncovering his feet. So when the cool air came, it would wake him up. Something startled the man, and he turned and discovered a woman lying at his feet. Who are you? He asked. I am Ruth, your servant. She said, spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer. Now listen to her proposal as she's stating a faith desire. She says, I am Ruth, and what I want you to do is spread the corner of your garment over me. Now, to us, that doesn't sound like much. But spreading your garment over a woman in those days was literally a proposal for marriage. In fact, in Ezekiel 16:8, it's pictured clearly that a man would take and spread his garment, his outer garment, the one that he uses to sleep in, spread that over a woman, was basically saying, I want to protect you, I want to take care of you, I want to provide for you, I want to be intimate with you, I want you to be close to me, I want to have sexual relationships with you, I want you to be my wife, I want us to be one. And so when she says this, she's saying to him, propose to me. Some of you would say, that's pretty forward. Yeah, it is pretty forward. But guys are often pretty dumb. Sometimes they need a little prompting along the way. Now, normally it would be the father in their culture who would come to the guy and say, we are open to this if this is something that you guys want. In this case, she didn't have that. And so here she was saying it herself. Now, she's also saying something else that's interesting. That phrase, spread the corner of your garment, is the same phrase that was used in Boaz's prayer in chapter 2. When Boaz said, may God bless you for coming and putting your trust in God to be a refuge in your life, who has spread his wings over you for protection. In other words, when he prayed that God would protect her with his wings, cover her with his wings, she's saying, hey, why don't you be the answer to your own prayer? Why don't you do for me what you prayed for me and be my protector, be my covering, be my security, be my support, be my husband? She says one other thing that's very, very important. The reason she gives for this proposal that he would choose her as his wife is based on the kinsman-redeemer relationship. See, she says, you are a near kinsman. Here's what she's saying. She's saying, according to the levirate custom of marriage, where if a husband dies, someone in his family, preferably his brother, would take her and raise up a child to keep the family name alive. He says, since you are blood to Elimelech, you are blood to Mahlon, that I'm asking you to marry me because what I want you to do is fulfill this family thing, this commitment of a family to raise up offspring for Naomi. In other words, I'm coming to you not just because you look good, not just because you're rich, not just because you could fulfill my needs, but I'm coming to you because I have bigger priorities. I want to see the family line carried on. In other words, what she's saying is, this is not simply selfish. It's not simply about me getting what I want. It's about me being part of something bigger than myself and finding my fulfillment in the process. Here's something really, really important for those of you who are contemplating marriage someday. If you marry someone purely for selfish reasons, this is here, this relationship is all about us two together being fulfilled. That's all we care about. It's just us two being happy. That's why we got married. It will become an issue for you later on, because if your primary motivation in marriage is self-satisfaction, there'll come a time when you'll turn to your spouse and you'll say, okay, fulfill me. Make me happy. That's your job. That's why I married you. Some of you have heard that, and all of you have said it in some way, shape, or form. When you marry for bigger reasons, because of the potential to bless our families with this union, because of the potential to move the kingdom forward because of this union, because of the contribution that we can make to the community, to the church, to the world with our union, we're coming together not just for us. This wedding, this marriage, this family will not just be for us. It's going to be for something bigger than us, for others as well. When that's the foundation of your marriage, you're on the right track toward not only finding fulfillment, but also meeting the needs of others. So she's saying, I don't want to just marry you for me. I want to marry you for our family and the impact it's going to have on my mother-in-law, whom I'm committed to. Too many kids today, young people, say, I don't really care what my family thinks. This is all about me. And there's lots and lots and lots of pain left in the wreckage of those kind of decisions. Watch Boaz's response, because she's put herself out there. She's laid it out. She said, hey, I'm available. And look how he responds in verse 10. He says, the Lord bless you, my daughter, he replied. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You did not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all that you ask. All my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of noble character. Now, earlier, Boaz was called a man of noble character. Now he's saying, everybody knows you as a woman of noble character. In other words, they're equally yoked. You have a guy who cares about God and family, cares about the community, cares about doing the right thing. You got a woman who cares about God and family, cares about the community, cares about doing the right thing. What a great match. Now they're matched up. but there's a glitch in it. And in every great romance, there's always an obstacle to this incredible love coming together. And that glitch is that there's part of this plan that is in God's sovereign timing that's not going to be fulfilled until there's one obstacle removed out of the way. So we would say it this way. They have to submit to the process that God has for them before they can move forward. And we see that process in the next few verses. He says, although it is true that I am near of kin, there is a kinsman redeemer nearer than I. In other words, there's a blood relative closer than me. He says, stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to redeem, good, let him redeem. But if he is not willing, I vow that as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. Lie here until morning. So she lay at his feet until morning, but got up before anyone could recognize. And he said, don't let it be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. So he protects her purity. He doesn't sleep with her during the night. He protects her reputation, gets her out of there before morning so nobody knows about it. He also said, verse 15, bring me the shawl you are wearing and hold it out. When she did so, he poured into it 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then he went back to town. When Ruth came to her mother-in-law, Naomi asked, now here's the understatement, how did it go, my daughter? Now, she's been there all night. So Naomi, who sent her on this risky mission, has been walking the floor all night, right? When she walks in the door, it's like, well, tell me everything. Start at the beginning. I want to hear it all. In fact, you know that's implied in the comment because the next verse says, then she told her everything Boaz had done for her, and she added, he gave these 6 measures of barley, saying, don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. Gentlemen, court the mother. That is a very, very wise thing to do. If you're going to bring your girl flowers, bring her mother flowers too. If you're going to bring your girl chocolates, bring your mother chocolates too. If you're going to buy your girl, you know, an outfit at Saks. Oh, no, don't go that far. That'd be weird. Build a relationship with the family. That's wise. The theological implication of this is Naomi said earlier that I went out full and I came back empty. Now as she's holding the grain in her hands that she's received, it's a foreshadowing of the fact that she's not going to be empty. She's going to have food. And in chapter 4, we're going to find out whether she has a child or not through this relationship with Boaz and Ruth. He's taking care of business. And the passage ends with Naomi saying to Ruth, we just need to wait because this man will not rest until this matter is settled. And that's how it ends. And we're not going to know what happened unless we either read ahead or come back next week. Will the love of her life be able to follow through, or is there a third party out there that's going to get her? Let me pull it all back together. A lot of lessons on the family. A lot of lessons on marriage, but there's one big lesson about God. And this big lesson about God is that oftentimes, in the normal, natural course of our life, God will put in front of us opportunities that seem risky, that seem like huge faith ventures, that seem like, man, do I have the courage to step out and in faith try this and see what happens? There may be someone here that you really believe that God wants you to marry, but you're not meeting anybody. And God's telling you to get out there. Let yourself be known. I mean, show up at the next big singles event and say, you know, my car ran out of gas. Can I ride with you guys? I mean, what does it take? That doesn't mean that you're pursuing. That means you're placing yourself in the way for God to do something incredible. It may be a job opportunity that you've had a desire, and you're just waiting. God's saying, go apply or go ask for the promotion. It may be a ministry that God has been prompting you to start, and you kind of feel this, and you go, I don't know. Is it really God? Is it really God? And God's telling you to risk, but here's the key. When Ruth went to Boaz, she was not desperate. She was only willing to present herself in a pure way. I mean, you think Naomi could have said, hey, listen, a girl in your situation, you need to do whatever you can to get a man. So go do whatever it takes to get him. That's not what they did. God never puts desperate and faith in the same sentence. So make sure that when you place yourself in these opportunities that seem risky, that you're not doing anything immoral or improper or compromising or being desperate. Just get in the way and say, hey, God, is this the job you want? Well, I'm going to go talk to somebody. Hey, is this the ministry you want me to start? I'm going to go see what it's all about. Is this the guy you want for me? I'm going to go find out. I'm going to go spend some time, get to know this person. Whatever it is, believe that God's sovereignty frequently is working out his providence through our activity, which gives us a lot of freedom to go out and live our lives, take some risks, and watch God do incredible things. I'd like to ask the men and women of our prayer team to make their way to the front. We're going to stand together at this time as we conclude our service. Now, these folks will be down here at the front and would love to have a chance to talk or pray with any of you guys about anything that's going on in your life. So if you're standing at the edge of that risky decision and you're asking yourself the question, should I leap? And you'd like to pray with someone or talk to someone about it, these folks would love to have a chance to talk to you. I'm going to be in the Connection Center at the end of the service, and I'd love to greet any of our guests or visitors. So come on by there. It's just out the back door and up the stairs to the right. We'd love to have an opportunity to do that. My prayer for you as you leave this place is that you would believe in such deep ways that in the same way that God was moving to bring Ruth and Boaz face to face, that God is moving in your life in some way, shape, or form today to place you where he wants you to be, so that you can see his power work in mighty ways. This time I'm going to ask one of our elders, Jim Rakes, to lead us in our benediction. Jim, thank you.